Aloha. My name is Harold Green, and I'm an alcoholic. And it's by the grace of God and the fellowship I've found here in Alcoholics Anonymous that it hadn't been necessary for me to have a drink of alcohol since February 1970. I take no credit for that. I had the extraordinary good fortune to walk into the rooms of Staten Island of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I sat down. And I took advantage of everything that was being given away. Now, my home group is the Monday Night Back to Basics group in Annapolis, Maryland, which, as everyone knows, the best group in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I can't tell you how pleased I am to be here. I have been to a lot of events, and I don't think I've enjoyed one more than I have since I've been here. It's been absolutely extraordinary. I have a Native American friend of mine lives out in Denver, Don C. And he has a saying, an Indian word, a Mohican word. It's Natashnaka. Natashnaka. It means the connectedness. The connectedness. That's what we had here. That's what I see here at the Big Bash. Strong, strong Natashnaka. I want to thank Rhea and John for their hospitality. Just been outstanding. I mean, just beautiful. And the speakers were just incredible. And I can't talk enough about Tommy and his wife. I mean, just unbelievable. Tommy say you're Portuguese and he don't stop talking. And he was right. And I have really enjoyed the speakers so far. They have been just outstanding. But I got to tell you, Linda, next time I go into to Trader Joe, I'm going to look over my shoulder if I go to mix nuts. It has been just great. Just everybody here has been just so wonderful. People have opened their homes to us, and we've just had a wonderful time. I had the good fortune, extraordinarily good fortune, to bring my son Ben. Ben, stand up. Ben was with. I bring Ben along to help keep me straight. just really tremendous effort that goes into these events, and I know how much it takes, and so I can't tell you how much I really appreciate all the hard work that was going into this. I was particularly impressed with the number of newcomers that you hear. There are people here with 11 days, 8 days. I mean, unbelievable. And I got to tell you, if you think this is great, you ain't seen nothing yet. I'm so pleased to see so many Al-Anons here. I love Al-Anons. I love Al-Anons. We get a lot of transfers. Did you know Al-Anons have slips? Yeah, Al-Anons have slips. There's fleeting moments of compassion. I love Al-Anons. I was out in North Dakota once with, I was speaking at a college, and there's a woman there that helped start AA in New York, Arbutus O'Neill. Arbutus is a beautiful lady, and I met her. She helped Lois start Al-Anon in New York. And she told a story about the time she went to a conference with a lot of people in treatment or working in the profession. And this psychiatrist got up and he told a story about how he had treated an alcoholic for a whole year. And after the year, the alcoholic went back home and his wife celebrated by giving him a bottle of wine. And Arbutus, after the meeting, went up to him and asked him, had he ever spoken to the family of the alcoholic? And he said, no. He said, have you ever told his wife about Al-Anon or the effect of alcoholism on a family? He said, no. He said, well, you ought to quit telling that story and make you sound like a damn fool. I love Al-Anon. They're not alcoholics, but they understand alcoholism. And I think that that's the real truth. I have had the extraordinary good fortune to serve as a trustee on the board of trustees. I was a chairman of the board of World Services, and in case some of you may not know what AA World Services is, it's where your money goes. Well, the money you drop in the plate, it goes to the World Services, and we publish and do a whole bunch of other things. But it was me, a drunk like me, handling all your money. And while I was in New York, I'm an old history teacher. I taught history in high school while I was doing a graduate degree. And I love history, so I gravitated toward the archives. And I read a lot of Bill Wilson's writings, a lot of his writings that aren't published. And whenever I had occasion to read a piece by Bill Wilson, one of the things that he always seemed to stress was that the alcoholic really has the only means of communicating with another alcoholic. That's the secret, if there's a secret at all. God gave us a special gift. He gave us the ability to talk to another alcoholic and have them hear what we say. I remember years ago I read an article by an old New Ager named, went out of my head, New Age writer. And he had written a piece in a New Age magazine, Aldous Huxley. He had written a piece in a New Age magazine. And in the piece, he said that Alcoholics Anonymous was one of the greatest social movements of the 20th century. And that's back in 1946. And I remember reading that article, and I went to my sponsor, and I asked my sponsor about it. He said, what Huxley was saying was that alcoholics were not elitists. What he said was that God always seemed to choose the least of them to show the others the way. And if you look at the disciples of Jesus, they were all common people. They were shepherds and fishermen. They were liars and thieves and prostitutes. Who's in AA? God gave us the least of them. Gave us the ability to talk to another alcoholic and have them hear what we say. We've been given that special gift. And Bill recognized that. Bill recognized that, and he really understood that to communicate with an alcoholic, you had to be very, very careful about telling them the truth. The truth will set you free. First, it will piss you off. I was a beat cop in New York for a number of years. I'll talk about that a little later. And while I was there, my beat, we didn't have the fancy squad cars then. We walked the beat, and my car box was on the corner, right on the corner of 116th Street and 7th Avenue. Anybody know Harlem? That's right up the street is mosque number 7. And I got to meet a man. His name was Haj Malik El-Shabazz. Many people knew him as Malcolm X. And I got to talk to Malcolm many times. And one of the things that Malcolm said to me, I never forgot. He said that no one can give you power. Power is something you have to take. I walked in here and I pick up our book and I see Bill Wilson has written The Great Reality. The real power is deep down within each and every one of us. Malcolm once said to me that truth without love is cruel. That confrontation without a solution is worthless. What we need to do here is look at the truth of ourselves, but we do it with love and compassion and understanding. So when we confront the truth of ourselves, there's a solution. The things that I understood at that time had no meaning for me later or did not compute later. I don't think anybody walks into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and fully understand what our 12-step process really is. I remember my sponsor used to talk about people who try to figure out powerlessness. He said, trying to figure out powerlessness is like sitting in a rocking chair. It won't get you no place, but it'll give you something to do. Bill wanted us to understand what powerlessness was, so he described, he told us what it was. And that was the message that he had as he came along. And I realized as I came to the recovery process, that I really didn't know a lot. I thought I did, and I think we all do. I grew up on the east side of Manhattan. I grew up in a section of New York called Spanish Harlem. Now, you grow up in Spanish Harlem, you grow up very quickly, or you might not grow up at all. See, in my old neighborhoods, by today's standards, they would probably consider me an entrepreneur. In those days, I was a hustler. I used to find stuff before it officially got lost. If it was small enough, I just stole it. If it was too big to carry, I lay down next to it and claimed it. In my old neighborhood, I remember one time they sent some social workers in there to study us. I never forget, one of them asked me how far it was to the subway. I told them I didn't know. Nobody ever made it. You come up in that kind of environment, you understand the day at a time. See, in my neighborhood, my philosophy, you do unto others before they do unto you. And so that was the kind of thing that happened when I was growing up. Everybody in my neighborhood drank. There was no shame to it or anything else. You drank, people didn't trust you if you didn't drink. And so drinking was part of the community, and I started drinking when I was a little kid. The thing of it is, they say hindsight is an exact science, and I believe it is. My father was an alcoholic. I didn't know that until I came here. My father was a kind and gentle man. He taught me how to read. Taught me how to read Dostoevsky, Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, and Khalil Gibran. I learned to read those writers years when I was a small child. But he would go out and get drunk, and he'd come back, and nobody knew who he was. He'd scream and holler and throw things. Everybody'd run and hide. I didn't understand then that alcoholism is a disease that tells us there's nothing wrong with us. Alcoholism is a disease that will cloud your mind, not having a sense of that whatsoever. Growing up in the streets of New York, I had a fundamental philosophy. We've kind of put a brick out here, a wall. And anytime somebody would try to get to know me or get to learn a little bit about me, I put another brick in that wall. And somebody would try to find out something about me or learn a little bit about me, I put another brick in that wall. And pretty soon that wall got higher and higher and higher. And one day I realized nobody could get to me because of the wall, but I was behind the wall and I couldn't get out. And I used to run into that wall. I'd hit that wall 14 times a day trying to figure out how to get around it. And I realized that I could have walked around it. There's a story my sponsor used to tell. He told it when I first came in. It must be 100 years old, and I'm sure everybody in here has heard it. But I like the way I tell it, so I'm going to tell it. The way you can tell an alcoholic from a non-alcoholic. There's two doorways at the end of a hallway. And inside one door, there's a sign that says peace and happiness. And inside the other door is a guy with a baseball bat. Now, the non-alcoholic walks down the hallway and he sees the two doors. He walks through the door and there's the guy in there with a bat, hits him right in the head. Comes out, goes across the hall, goes through the door, there's peace and happiness, and he has peace and happiness for the rest of his life. Well, the alcoholic comes down the hallway. He sees the same two doors. Walks through the door. There's the guy with the bat. Hits him right in the head. Turns around. Comes back down the hallway. Turns around. Right back up the hallway. Same two doors. Walks through the door. The guy with the bat right there. Hits him right in the head again. Turns around. Comes back down the hallway. Goes back up the hallway. He gets halfway up there. And he stops and he says, maybe he won't be in there this time. Maybe I can get away with it. So the alcoholic goes through the door where the guy with the bat was, and he's gone. And the alcoholic goes looking for him. We have a disease that tells us there's nothing wrong with us. We have a disease that will cloud our minds and confuse us into believing that we are who we're not. Silkworth writes in the book, he talks about the alcoholic is the drinking becomes so injurious, the alcoholic cannot differentiate the truth from the false. And that's really what happens. And I think that the alcoholic, at least in my case, really wanted to be a real person, a good person. We had all the attributes that we have, and I think alcoholics are really extraordinary people. But because of the narrowness and focus of our disease, we become different. We become different people. When I walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had no sense of that. I didn't know any of that. Growing up in New York, last years of high school, they started to draft people. And I knew that they were going to draft me as soon as I got out of high school. So I did the really cool, slick New York thing. I joined the National Guard. I joined the National Guard, and I joined probably the oldest military organization in the United States at that time, no black African-American unit, the old 369. As a matter of fact, the 369 were originally the 9th Cavalry. And the 9th Cavalry was the same outfit that rode up San Juan Hill with Teddy Roosevelt in the Spanish-American War. Well, I met guys that had been drinking since they rode up San Juan Hill with Teddy Roosevelt in the Spanish-American War. And I think that if I had to pinpoint my alcoholism and where it began, that would be it. Because I had gone to a vocational high school and I knew math and physics and technical concepts, they sent me to school. I went to schools almost the entire time the unit was on active duty. And they sent me down to military schools all around the country. And the first school that I went to was down on the right on the border of Juarez, in a place called El Paso. I don't know if anybody's ever been down. El Paso in those days used to be able to walk across the bridge. I think it cost a penny to walk across the bridge into Juarez. And I'll never forget it. You could buy, there was a drink called Oso Negro Gin, Black Bear Gin, just to a 44 cent a quart. Buddy and I was walking down the streets of Juarez breaking gin bottles on the lamppost, which the and the rains came. Okay. As long as it doesn't rain in here, it's okay. Let's give them a chance to pull those curtains down. Hey, Ben, you have to take some pictures. Okay, I guess you talk about a spiritual awakening. God really had a plan for us tonight. Well, down in El Paso, I got into trouble again. Walking around down in Texas, getting in trouble, a friend of mine breaking gin bottles on a lamppost, which the Mexican police take a very dim view of. And I wound up in a Mexican jail. Now, I've been in a lot of jails in time. When I was a little kid, you go to the movies and you'd see Errol Flynn movies, and he'd be the pirate captain, and they'd be sword fighting and going on, and then they catch him and throw him in the dungeon. And you see these big blocks of wood and chains on the wall that they'd hang people on. I used to think that was make-believe till I got in a Mexican jail. The thing about it is I was boxing, and I had a fight coming up. And my CO was a fight fan. He came in and got me out. Just came in and got me out. And I think that that's the real dilemma of the alcoholic. We get into some of the damnedest things, and somehow we manage to get out. I'll never forget once they asked me to leave jail. They asked me to leave. Little town, upstate New York, I'm sitting on the curb, sucking out of a wine bottle, and the police came by and said, get in. They put me in their car, took me to a jail, a brand new jail, they had just built it. Put me in a cell, I laid down, lit a cigarette, and the mattress caught on fire. They took me out of that cell, crossed the hall to another cell, put me in a cell, laid down, lit a cigarette, fell asleep, and the mattress caught on fire, and the guy came in there and said, you have to leave. And they put me out. I really didn't want to go. It never occurred to me how bizarre that was. We have a disease that tells us there's nothing wrong with us. And so my career went on, and I got into trouble everywhere I went. They sent me down to Huntsville, run Red Store and Arsenal. I was down there when Wernher von Braun was testing intercontinental ballistic missiles. And I got in trouble there. And the same thing happened. I got into trouble, and somehow I managed to get out. And then the unit had been over on the first tour in Vietnam. They came back, and they got deactivated. For the first time, they got reactivated again and went back. But they got deactivated, and I came back from Texas, and I was looking for a job. The unit was back off active duty. I was looking for a job. And I when I came out of the military, I had a lot of good skills. As a matter of fact, I'm probably one of the few people that know how to arm a barometric fuse for a hydrogen warhead. They taught me how to do that. I used to wonder what would happen if I was drunk one time sitting at a console and hit the wrong button. So I'm looking for a job, and they didn't seem to have a big demand for people that knew how to arm barometric fuses in the South Bronx at the time. So I took a test, and I'm a good test taker. And I wound up on New York City Police Department. And I walked the beat in Manhattan. I walked the beat in the same streets I grew up in. And I knew every pimp, every numbers dealers, every dope dealers around. I remember once I locked a guy up for being drunk. And they had to carry me in the courthouse. By this time, all the guys, the gang around the blocks were breaking up, and everybody was getting married. And I did another really alcoholic thing. I got married. And the reason I got married was because my brother got married. And I always wanted to be this responsible person. I always wanted to be this person that people looked up to. But I had no sense of responsibility, and I married a beautiful person. Alcoholics always marry beautiful people. Al-Anons will tell you that. I married a beautiful person, and they like most Al-Anons, they become our greatest enablers. And that's what happened. My wife was a beautiful person. I loved her dearly. I loved my children dearly, but I couldn't stop drinking. I went to work from time to time, but I drank. I remember coming home from work. And my wife would have prepared a very nice meal. And I would walk in and walk right to the back, close the door, and start to drink and drink and drink. By this time, we had two small children, and they needed things. And my wife would be asking me for money for them, and the job would be after me. They like you to show up from time to time, and things were just going down and down and down and down. And then one day, it occurred to me, and if you can do this, you can take this disease to the moon. One day, it occurred to me, it was all their fault. If this job would just stop bothering me for this money, and my wife would stop asking me for money for the kids, and people would leave me alone, these bill collectors would stop bothering me, everything. I used to get these letters with the big red letters on the outside say, pay up or die. If these people would just leave me alone, I'd be okay. And so I did what a lot of alcoholics do. I ran. I got up and I walked out of my house, left my wife and the children, just walked out. I get sick every time I think about it. And I've made amends for that, but it still is a part of me that I can't ever forget. The alcoholic in me had no way of dealing with things beyond its control. I didn't know how to live and let go. And so I wound up out in the street, and I was living in one room. And you've seen the pictures around the rooms of AA with a guy sitting on the bed and two men trying to talk to him. That was me. In one dark, dingy room with a broken lampshade and a dangling window shade, trying to find peace of mind. Finally, I couldn't afford the room. And I wound up out in the street, walking the street, eating out of garbage cans, drinking wherever I could, living in basements. I'll never forget, I was living in a basement, a dark, dingy basement. It was underneath the railroad trestle. I'll never forget it. Because it had a dirt floor. And every time the burner, they had an automatic burner in that basement, and every time it would fire, I'd hear Handel's Messiah, the whole hallelujah chorus. I hate the thing today. I used to see lions and tigers going through that basement. And one day I came to in that basement, and I looked around, and I asked myself, what are you doing here? Why are you in this basement? I come from a good family. I got a relatively good education. Why are you here? And I really had no good understanding for that. I had no good answer. And so I did what I always did when I got into a jackpot. I was going to pray. When I was a little kid and they took you to church, I guess everybody goes to church. I went to church and I listened very carefully to what the preacher said. And what I heard the preacher say was when God was somebody you could make a deal with. Yeah, you do this for me, and I'll do that for you. And so every time I got into a jackpot, that's what I would do. Get me out of this. And nothing happened. At least I thought nothing happened. I know today that God was there. God hadn't gone anywhere. God was there all the time. All I had to do was turn around and reach out. One of my favorite books in the other big book, the Bible, is Ecclesiastics. And the Ecclesiastics write in their book, they say for everything there is a season and a purpose for everything under the heaven. There is a time to be born and a time to die. I believe there's a line somewhere. There is a point beyond which God will not permit us to endure pain. We all reach that point at some time, and when some of us reach it, we die. When some of us reach it, we find our way into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. But whether we die or whether we come here, God has arranged that we don't have to suffer anymore. One of my favorite writers is a man named Walter Benton. And in one of his writings, he describes what happens to us. He says that our days are of time and hours. And as the clock hand turns, a circle closes in upon us. And a black, timeless night sucks us in like quicksand and receives us totally without a rain check or a parachute or a key to heaven or a last long look. The alcoholic spirals down and down and down and down, and then for some inexplicable reason, God reaches in and plucks some of us out, sets us into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've long since stopped trying to understand why some of us are here, some of us are not. I do believe that God has a plan. He has a plan for each and every one of us, and we're part of it. I learned that as I began to take advantage of the principles that we learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, I began to learn and understand. I didn't know that then. What happened was, I was one morning I woke up and some colleagues of mine had invested in a bottle of wine. And we were in the process of drinking a bottle of wine and got a phone call that said I had to come down to the hospital. I had been driving trucks back and forth from a dump for a few months just to keep drinking money. And I had ran the truck off the road and it hit an embankment. Nothing serious happened. But they came, got truck back up on the road and said, suggested I go to get an x-ray. Well, I had went and got the x-ray and I came back. And the next day we had a bottle of wine and I had forgotten all about it. And I got a phone call that said I had to come down to the hospital right away. Well, I tried to explain to this lady I had just invested in a bottle of wine. And I wasn't going anywhere. But she said that if you don't come down here, we're going to send somebody out to get you. The last thing I need was people looking for me. So I go down, and not to make a long story longer, turns out I had tuberculosis. And I had it so severely, they wouldn't let me go back home. They put me in an ambulance, and they shipped me out, way out in the tip end of Staten Island in an isolation ward, a place called Seaview Hospital. And I stayed out there the next year and a half. And I realized today, in hindsight, that God doesn't allow us to suffer anymore. And I realized that was God reaching out, and it was probably the best thing that had ever happened to me. And it may seem strange saying getting a serious disease like tuberculosis was a good thing, but for me it was. While I was in the hospital, I had all my needs taken care of. They even took you to the bathroom in a wheelchair, so I was in bed for almost the entire time. And I had an opportunity to stop and think and look back over my life. And I saw that every single time I got into any difficulty, any time I went to jail or lost a job or got into a fight, anything sometimes bad had happened to me, I was either drinking or I was drunk. And I believe it was in the hospital that cement block lifted and the message went through. There's something wrong with you. It has to do with alcohol. I never will forget the supervising nurse on my ward. I was sitting, that was the day before I was to be discharged. The supervising nurse was coming through the ward, and she saw me sitting on the side of the bed. I know I was leaving there the next day. It's very quiet and very subdued, which is not my normal state. And she asked me what was wrong, and I told her I was afraid. I was afraid to go back out in the street. I knew that every time that I walked out in the street, the minute I stepped across that door sill, I'd be just like Alice in Wonderland, just running twice as fast to stay exactly where I was. And I told her I was afraid. And she asked me the question that we all get asked in one form or another, do you really want help? And again, God, grace, simple, coming into my life, I said, yes, I need help. And she arranged for me to get to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I got sober down on the South Shore of Staten Island. I don't know if anybody's ever heard of the John Birch Society. Well, the John Birch Society, probably the most right-wing conservative organization in the world. There are people on the South Shore of Staten Island who think the John Birch Society are liberals. I walked into the first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous down the South Shore of Staten Island, and the minute I walked through the door, I knew that there was something wrong. The first thing you noticed was there were no black people in there. The other thing was, this was the middle of February, and there were guys in there wearing white shoes in the winter. They don't wear white shoes in the summertime in Spanish Harlem. I said, these are some very strange people, and I need to get out of here. And I was headed toward the door, and the guy walked up to me, and he showed me this blue book. And he said that everything that you will ever need in life is in this book. Well, my scheme in mind went right to work. If everything I needed was in that book, I read this book and figure out how to get a loan out these people. So I took that book and I read it. Read it from cover to cover. And I came back and I told him his name was Ellie. God bless him. He was a civil engineer, about that high. And I said, Ellie, I can't get a loan out of this book. And he said, yes, you can. And I must have read that book 100 times by now. And I still can read a book and get an answer that I need from it. So Ellie told me, he said, I'm going to be your sponsor because you don't have brains enough to get one. And you know, normally I come up out of the street and my philosophy is interfere with me, you had to fight. But I have been with this guy for a while now. And I said, okay, I'll listen to what he said. And he started walking through, we started walking through this recovery process. And the thing I loved about him, probably more than anything else, is that he always explained to me what we're going to do. What we're going to do. I never will forget, I was going to give him the 15-cent version of my life story. And he stopped me cold. And he said, we're not interested in who you are. We're going to find out who you are not. And we're going to get rid of all of that. And who you are will show up. And we started walking through this process. He used to call it connecting the dots. That's what we're going to do. We're going to connect the dots. And when we're done, we're going to have a picture. And so we began to walk through this recovery process. And for newcomers coming in, I think it's really important. It was important to me for him to put it in terms that I understood. You know, we can get in here for a while and we have our own code. And we talk among ourselves and we know exactly what we're talking about. But a newcomer coming in here and hear us say, easy does it. What are you talking about? First things first. What is first? And we start going on and on, and they don't have a clue. What I try to do, particularly with newcomers, is do what he did with me. Explain to me in terms I could understand, in graphic terms. He used to tell me that when Bill wrote the steps, the thing he wanted people to know most than anything else was, what was wrong with you? Why are you here? Why did you come in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous? Well, he said, you're powerless over alcohol. That's the problem. You're powerless over alcohol. Your life's unmanageable. You don't have to figure anything out. Like he said, trying to figure out powerlessness is like sitting in a rocking chair. It'll give you something to do, but it won't get you no place. You're powerless over alcohol, and your life's unmanageable. Now, as I came into the process, and I walked through it, and I looked back in hindsight, I could see it all. I saw the unmanageability and all of it. I used to wake up in the morning and I make a solemn commitment that I would not get drunk that day. And by noon, I'd be drunk. I used to think I just changed my mind. Had no idea I had no power not to pick up a drink. So now I know what the problem is. I have no power. Now, if having no power is the problem, then finding a power is the solution. And he wrote step 2. Come to believe that there's a power greater than yourself that can restore your sanity. That's the answer. When Bill first wrote the steps, we had a 12-step program already in place. People were getting sober. If you look in the preface of the first edition, you see it says, we are 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. The purpose of this book is to tell other alcoholics precisely how we did it. Well, Bill went to those people and he asked them what they did. And they told him, we did the steps. And now we know there is a power greater than ourselves that can restore us to sanity because it happened to us. And when I picked up the book and I read that, I knew there was hope for me. There was hope for me. So I know what the problem is. I have no power. I know what the solution is. Find the power. All I need is a direction to go. And you're on step 3. Make a decision. Turn your will and your life over to the care of God as you understood him. Now that made absolutely no sense to me whatsoever. But then in the book, Bill knew that. He knew he was going to run up against guys like me. So he wrote a little prayer just for me, dummy, just for me. And he says in the prayer that we're asking, give myself to thee, do with me as thy will, remove me from the bondage of myself, so that victory over my difficulties will be a witness of thy love that strengthen thy way of life. May I do your will always. Now I have a direction to go. And the essence of it is, get out of the way. Get out of the way. Let something else come into your life. Let something else make that direction for you. And so now I have a simple beginning of the process. Bill calls it the foundation, the cornerstone, and the cornerstone and the center stone, keystone. And the keystone, anyone that's ever built an arch knows, is the most important stone in an arch because all the other stones lay against it. And I began to walk through the rest of the process. I looked at myself. I looked at the truth of myself. And I remember what Malcolm said. Truth without love is cruel. Confrontation without a solution is worthless. But when I looked at the truth of myself, I did it with love and compassion and understanding. And people with sensitivity, my sponsor, helped me understand the truth of myself. And I come to understand that I'm a product of my experience. That's what I am. I'm a product of my experience. My experience determines my behavior today. I need to look at that. How did I get to do the things that I did? So I looked at that. I looked at the things that made me angry, the things that I was fearful of, the things that helped defeat me in sexual experiences. And I understood that most of the time I was the problem. I didn't understand that. Most of the time, the things that occurred to me, I caused. So I hid the truth of myself, and I looked at myself, and I saw who I was. And we come to a point where not only did I write it down, I told it to somebody else. And we come to a point where we have to make a decision. Are you willing to be the same person, or do you want to change? Do you really want to be the same person, or do you want to change? And all we have to do comes to the sixth step, and it says, become ready to have God remove all his defects of character. Well, I wasn't really sure I wanted to have all my defects of character removed. I didn't want to get too honest too fast. The statute of limitations hadn't run out on some of my stuff. But Ellie said, you've got nothing to do with it. You have absolutely nothing to do with it. If you're ready to change, all you have to do is ask. Simply ask. And that's what I did. And again, for dummies like me, he wrote a prayer. My Creator, I give myself to thee. Do with me as thy will. Remove from me every single defect of character that stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. And so I did that. I read that prayer, said the prayer, said it out loud. And I went back to Ellie and I told him what I had read. And he said, no, read it again. And I did. And then I realized what he was saying. I figured that after I read that prayer and asked God to remove these defects to carry, at the very least, I get a halo or a set of wings. I go skipping through the tulips. Ellie said, no. What the prayer says, remove these defects of character so that I can be useful. That's the key. So that I can be useful. And I come to understand that if we're going to grow spiritually, we have to be useful. I didn't understand that then. Recovery from alcoholism is a spiritual recovery, but spirituality cannot occur in a vacuum. Spirituality has to be anchored in something altruistic. If we're going to grow spiritually, we have to do something for someone with no expectation. Bill said it a different way. We have to give it away to keep it. And I began to understand. And at the same time, this process was beginning to open my mind. and I was beginning to see things in a different way. And I loved the, when I studied philosophy, I had a German philosopher who used the term Weltanschauung a lot. Weltanschauung is German for the word, the world view, how we see the world. And my view began to change. Clancy talks about that. We have a disease of perceptions. And my perceptions began to change. I began to see people differently, ideas differently, not realizing that that was what was happening to me. It was almost as though sitting in the rooms, something was precipitating, sprinkling down, and the knowledge was coming to me. And I think that it's one of the really great, valuable lessons that we learn here. Probably the greatest lesson that we learn in Alcoholics Anonymous over and above sobriety is the ability to listen carefully. And I began to listen and listen more and more and more. And I went out and I made amends to people that had harmed me because I forgave them. Did not understand that. Forgiving people who have harmed you was totally alien to me. I come from the South Bronx. Before I came to Maryland, I was a general contractor. And I used to do a lot of retrofit work for HUD, ADA retrofits for public housing. And I had a small contract. Normally, if you have a contract with a government contract, you have to bid it out. But this was a small contract under a certain dollar amount, and I could give it away. And I gave it away to a guy. A guy came in and asked me if he could have the contract, and I gave it to him. Then he told me he didn't have any money to buy materials. So I fronted him the money to buy the materials. And the guy stiffed me. He took off with my money. I went to his house. I went to his office. I could not find this guy. I have some friends that live over in Brooklyn, in Flatbush, and they specialize in kneecapping. I was going to get some of these guys to speak to this guy seriously. At the very least, I was going to back one of my cement trucks up to his house and fill up his living room. I made the mistake of telling my sponsor what I was going to do. He said, "No, you have to pray for him." Well, I thought that was the dumbest thing I ever heard. You do not pray for people who steal your money where I come from. But I had been with this guy for a while now, and I had faith. Bill talks about it. Faith the size of a mustard seed. I had that much faith, so I said, "Okay, I'm going to pray for this guy." You should have heard this prayer. "Listen, God, I'm going to pray for this SOB. I hope he have a heart attack." "Nothing serious, you understand. Only he shouldn't recover." Well, I prayed that prayer for a while. I don't know, maybe a month, 6 weeks I prayed. And I don't know when it happened or how or exactly when, but like the string out of an orange, the anger and resentment was gone. And I learned a valuable lesson. First, be very careful what you pray for. Because when God really wants to punish you, he will answer your prayer. The other thing is that when you pray, there's always an answer. Always an answer. And so I learned some very, very valuable lessons about prayer and understanding and listening to the power greater than myself determine my outcome. And I started to build on that and used it. At about the same time I was coming out of the hospital, my wife had developed cancer and died. And my two boys were in foster care. And I went to Ellie and I said, "Ellie, I want to get my two boys back." And he told me that, "Be careful what you pray for." And so I got them back, two of them, both of them. Spent the next 10 years raising them. And I'm happy to say they're two beautiful young men. They're both in law enforcement. And they're a joy to be around, both of them today. And I think that it was that kind of sense of belonging that began to give me some sense of responsibility. I'll never forget when my mother was diagnosed with diabetes. And she got very, very ill. And then they came and they had to take her leg off. And they told me, and I was the one that went and told her that they were going to take her leg off. And I held her hand all the way up to the operating room and told her I loved her when they took her inside. And then she came out and I nursed her myself. And all the time I had the strength and love and understanding of the people around Alcoholics Anonymous that held me up. I would never have been able to carry that out. And when she passed, the funeral home that where she was laid out was packed. My aunts and sisters and brothers was wondering, who are all these people? They were members of AA that had come there for support. That's the kind of Netashnikov that can't be bought anywhere. It's ours. It's ours. We have to claim that. It's ours, and we have to use it to help other people. And so things went on like that. And I was moving through this process and I was learning and gaining. I began to understand what a spiritual life was really all about. Then one day my group was having a business meeting and I went out to the bathroom. When I came back, I was the GSR. I didn't know what a GSR was. But I was a GSR back in Staten Island. In those days, there were only 7 groups in the entire county. And so I became a GSR. And I began to work my way up through the steps. And I met a woman, a good friend of mine. Her name was Jackie Solomon. And she was part-time Bill Wilson's secretary. And she was my service sponsor. And Jackie said, I was to be nominated as a delegate back in 1970. And there was a vacancy that came up on the World Services Corporate Board, and she said, "Put your resume in for the opening." And I did. I didn't want to, but I did. And so I became a director on the World Services Corporate Board, and that was an experience all by itself. Tremendous experience. It was the time when the Berlin Wall was coming down. And we were doing all kinds of things with translations sending our message to all the Eastern Bloc countries, Czechoslovakia and Latvia and Romania. I never forget, we were at a regional forum and we were talking about that. And everybody was so happy and so joyful about the fact that we were finally being able to penetrate into some of those Eastern Bloc countries. AA had always been in some of the countries. They had been in Finland for years and in Poland, but not in Russia and some of the Eastern Bloc countries because of their politics. And so finally we began to go through there and translate our book in there, and we were very happy about it. And at a regional forum, we were talking about that, and a guy in the back stood up and asked, how many languages have our book been translated into from the African language of Swahili? It got as quiet there as it did in here. It wasn't any. But because of the dedication and the commitment of our staff in New York, we had been corresponding with a priest in Kenya, and he had translated our book. And we wrote him. He wrote us back, sent us the translation, and we edited it. And not to make a long story longer, 6 months later, we had the book Alcoholics Anonymous in Swahili. The thing that was really extraordinary, the guy that asked the question at the regional forum was an African from Kenya. And he was having his 10th anniversary, and he asked if I would speak at his anniversary. And I was able to take the first book of Alcoholics Anonymous in Swahili and present it to him on his 10th anniversary. And that was extraordinary. God does move. And so my life began to change as I began to walk through this process. I had came off the job, and I went back to school, and I got some degrees. As a matter of fact, I probably got every degree City University had at that time. And I became a general contractor, and I started building houses. And I built houses and ran public housing all around the country, in different parts of the country. And one of the things when I first started in public housing, working, contracting, We were always in a poor community, and the community was usually beset with a lot of problems. Because of my background, I started boxing programs in every one of them. I started boxing programs, and I started getting kids out of the street and into the gym. And we reduced our crime rate in most of those cities by half very early on. And so the things began to grow and grow. And then one day, a good priest, a friend of mine, Joe Madonna, asked me about men coming out of prison in Maryland. Apparently there was a consent decree that came out from the Justice Department, and it says that when a facility goes over a certain percentage, they have to let people out, and they were letting people out back into the community with very little experience, very little understanding. So I set a program up to start to train men coming out of prison and coming back into the community. It's been going on. I've been doing it for the past 7 years. And I think that it's probably one of the greatest things for me, confidence-wise and responsibility-wise, I've ever done. To see these men that come out very hopeless, many of them with drug and alcohol problems, to turn around and turn their lives around and go out in the world and be productive citizens. I learned that here. I learned that here in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I never would have been able to do any of that if I hadn't walked in here and sat down and listened to people like you and hear what I said. There's no magic in AA. I tell people that all the time. We have no magic here. The power is in our experience. The power is in our collective and our individual experience, and that experience are in these rooms. I love to see newcomers walk into a room of Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time, and somebody will walk up to them and say, "Keep coming back." You know, somebody you don't even know get right in your face and tell you, "Keep coming back." Say something stupid in here and they'll tell you, "Keep coming back." They're saying, "Come back to where the power is." The power is in our experience. The power is right here. That's where it is. And that's what we have, and we learn right here that in order to keep it, we have to give it away. And I've learned that here, and I see that in the strength of this island bash. It may be seem like a lot of fun, and it certainly is, but it's a grounding for someone who comes in here for the first time, who might be lost, might be really, really feel helpless and disturbed, and walk into a room like this. I love it. I've just thought of it. When my sponsor used to talk about people coming into AA for the first time, he told this story, and I never will forget it. And it's had to do with a guy that died. Guy died, went to heaven, and he got up to the pearly gates, and there was St. Peter's at the pearly gates. And St. Peter asked the guy for his name. He gave him his name. He checked him off. He says, "Okay, what's your religion?" The guy said, "Well, I don't have a religion." Well, St. Peter said, "You have to have a religion. You can't come to heaven if you don't have a religion." He said, "Never mind, come with me." St. Peter walked down the hallway, and they come to a door. When they open the door, there's a bunch of people in there, and they're on their knees, and they're praying, and they didn't look too happy. And the guy said, "Well, who are those?" He said, "Those are the Protestants." He said, "Well, I don't think I want to belong to that." He said, "Not to worry." Took him down the hallway a little further. There's another doorway, golden doorway. Another bunch of people down on their knees. They're counting beads and praying and going on. And they didn't look too happy. And the guy says, "Well, who are those?" He said, "Well, those are the Catholics." And he said, "Well, I don't think I want to belong to those." He said, he goes down the hallways. He opens the door. And there's a bunch of people inside. And they're laughing and hugging and kissing and having a wonderful time. And the guy says, "Well, who are those?" And St. Peter says, "We don't know. They won't tell us." They say that we're anonymous. Natashinaka. Strong Natashinaka. I learned that from being here in Alcoholics and Learning. I learned how to be a person, to be live among other people and understand how other people love us so that we can love them. Love and compassion. I come to understand what Bill writes in our book. Bill says, the great reality, the real power, is deep down within each and every one of us. And then he goes on to tell us that The way to find it is to rid yourself of all bias. Think honestly and look inside yourself diligently, and the power will emerge. And as we walk through this process, we begin to see the power emerging over and over and over again. And the people that come in here with love and understanding, I love to see women when they come to Alcoholics Anonymous. We have this kind of double standard. Well, a man can go out in the street and get drunk and lay down and roll around in the gutter, get up the next day, put on a clean shirt and tie, and nobody thinks anything about it. But if a woman does exactly the same thing, somehow she's marked. There's a difference. There's something somehow like a demon on their shoulder that whispers in their ear that you have no worth. And then when they come to Alcoholics Anonymous, we say, come in here. Let us love you until you love yourself. And you see women change almost overnight to beautiful, beautiful flowers. And they begin to smile from in here and not with their teeth. And you know God is in his heaven. And all's right with the world. Alcoholics is not a perfect plan. It's not a perfect plan, but it's the plan that was set out for us. And as we move through this process, we make it better. One of my favorite pamphlets in AA is a pamphlet called A Member's Eye View. If you haven't read it, it's a wonderful pamphlet, very simple. It's required reading for all my pigeons. And the pamphlet is an alcoholic talking to a group of non-alcoholics. And what he says is, nothing that we do in here is new. Nothing in alcoholics and nothing in our principles are new. The reason that our principles work are because they are true principles. And they will work for anyone. And so we come to understand that the principles that lead us to a power greater than ourselves are not new. They're ours, and they're there all the time. You hear the expression that we're here by the grace of God, and that's absolutely true. But the grace of God didn't drop down out of the sky. We had it all the time. We were born perfect children of God, all of us. We were born perfect children of God. Nothing can ever change that. No matter where you go, whatever happens to you in life, you will always be a perfect child of God. And what happens is that our experiences impact us and convince us that we're less than perfect. And we come to Alcoholics Anonymous and we clear away the wreckage. We clear away those bricks and blocks and we allow the sunlight to come into us. And we come to find out that the grace was there all the time. All we had to do was reach in and take it out and use it in a hard-nosed, practical way. That's the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. I go up to a sweat lodge in a place called Minot, North Dakota, tribe of Chippewa Indians, and their sweat lodge is on the side of a mountain. It's called Turtle Mountain. And they're known as the Turtle Mountain Chippewa. And anybody who's ever gone to a sweat lodge knows the first time you go into a sweat lodge, you have to walk up to the fire pit carrying a rock with no clothes on. And that's what I had to do. I'm walking down this row of elders carrying this rock. And one of them in the back stood up and pointed to me and he said, "New Mark." And then another one got up and pointed to me and said, "New Mark Ha." I come to understand that New Mark Ha means walking bear. And they said that was I looked like, a walking bear. It became my name. I'm an honorary member of the Turtle Mountain Chippewa. My name is Newmark Hawk, Walking Bear. And while I was there the first time, an old elder got up and told a story about the wounded healer. And the wounded healer is an Indian spirit, and he doesn't do anything until a warrior is wounded. And when a warrior is wounded, the spirit appears in front of him. And he opens his cloak, and he has a wound exactly like the warrior's. And the warrior looks at the spirit's wound, and he gets healed. The first time I heard that story, I said, that's what we do. That's what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. Every time we share our strength and hope and experience, we show somebody our wounds. and they get healed. And we all wounded healers. And I think that as we go forth, the challenge that we have is to take the message that's in our book. Take the message in our book. It's the real message. Our fellowship is only 75 years old. By any standards, we're brand new. It took 200 years to write the Bible. So Alcoholics Anonymous is not an old group. We're new. We have to take the message in our book and pass it through the fabric of our lives. And then pass it on and out to the guy or the gal that walks in here for the first time. Listen, I'm getting down from here. In that same pamphlet, A Member's Eye View, toward the end, the writer takes kind of a biblical turn. And he talks about the time that John the Baptist was once again in one of Herod's prisons for about the 100th time. And while he was in prison, John heard about his cousin, Jesus. And Jesus was about the land doing all kinds of miraculous things. And John called two of his followers to him, and he said to them, "Go and find Jesus and ask him if he is the Messiah. Ask him if he's the one we've been waiting for." So the two men go out, and they find the Lord, and they walk with him for a while. And then one day, they ask him, "Are you the Messiah? Are you the one we've been waiting for?" And Jesus didn't answer him directly. What he said was, "Go back to John and tell John only what you have seen and only what you have heard. Tell John that the blind can see and the deaf can hear and the lame can walk and the poor in spirit have been given the good news." Well, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I can make a report to you tonight if you'll accept it. I know for a fact that the blind can see and the deaf can hear. And the lame can walk. And the poor in spirit have been given the good news that Alcoholics Anonymous is here for each and every one of us. God bless you all. Thank you.